Very happy to be here chatting to Benjamin Studebaker once again. Been on the podcast before. We've been a live event as well of yours, I guess, on your very good book. And so I thought we could extend this discussion. I guess it's part of a longer discussion that we're having, but you've just written a short blog piece about the millennial left. So I thought I'd welcome you back on the BungaCast. How's it going?
It's great to be back. I love doing this show.
Excellent. Love to hear that. And it's always good to talk to you. So I'm looking forward to doing a chat about media, basically extending the discussion and debate about the millennial left that's been going on to media. So just to set a couple of touchstones on this, I mean, listeners will probably be familiar, but your book, which we discuss on this podcast, is somewhat about the millennial left, I guess. It's not directly about it, but it certainly touches on the historical moment of the 2010s. There's our book, the BungaCast book, which came out in 2021, which has its main secondary topic, I guess, the millennial left. And then there have been recent books out from Chris Cutrone. Again, just put this, unlocked that episode very recently. A book by Anton Yeager and Arthur Borriello. Material of that was discussed on this podcast already back in 2019, 2020, and has been extended now in the form of this book on the populist moment, and then the book by Vincent Bevins about protest around the world. And then there's I reviewed these three books. There's also been reviews of these books out by, or most of those books, by James Butler in the London Review of Books, by Will Davis in the New Statesman. And now you've just written this blog piece kind of adding to the discussion. So anyway, it's obviously like an ongoing thing, and this isn't going to be in any way definitive, but I wanted to tease at some of the kind of media elements, which you kind of say, well, you know, that's neglected in this discussion. Actually, the millennial left was just a moment in internet history. So maybe I'll let you explain, first of all, what you mean by that.
Yeah. I've loved a lot of this stuff that's come out in recent years. I love these postmortems because they're so good at helping us delve into why we should be in despair. I think that there's a danger that the millennial left moment is going to get sucked up into this Gen X thing. A lot of the stuff that gets attributed to the millennial left, I view as 80s baby stuff, as right. You know, the protest movements, the Occupy, the anti-imperialism, anti-globalization, anti-war, anti-racism. There's a kind of before and after resistance liberal thing that sits on both sides of the millennial left moment. And we're back into this resistance space. We're back into a lot of Gen X protesting. And to me, the protesting, that wasn't really millennial left. The millennial left was an attempt to do something positive that wasn't just resistance politics and wasn't just protest. And it was driven, I think, by computer people. And when I say computer people, I mean people for whom the computer is home. The computer is what you did when you came home from school. You got on the computer, and that's where you're comfortable, and that's where you're safe, right? And before and after the computer people, there are phone people. There are analog phone people. And then there are cell phone people. And these people are different. They don't live in the computer the way that the millennial left lived in the computer. Mm-hmm. And I think that for millennial leftists, all of this stuff that went on in the 2000s and in the early 10s, including Occupy, was kind of disappointing. We looked at all of that stuff and we went, nothing really got accomplished from doing that. We need to do something more positive. And at a lot of points in these discussions, this is treated as a pivot. You know, the millennial left pivoted from protest into electoral politics.
Yeah.
I kind of want to make this line sharper. No, that's really when the millennial left begins as something distinct and different from Gen X politics. And that really what you have there is Gen X politics, which 80s babies who are called millennials, but are not digital natives, are not computer people. That's what they're doing. Like if you look at Pete Buttigieg, you know, he's born in 83. He's called a millennial. He's not a computer person. If you ask him, to come up with a plan to put a Conestoga wagon, to Oregon, right? He wouldn't know how to do that. He hasn't played Oregon Trail 2. He doesn't know, right? 80s
babies. I played Oregon Trail 1 and it was great.
Oregon Trail 1 doesn't count. Oregon Trail 1 doesn't count. It has to be Oregon Trail 2 because that's the one that came out in 1995 and was on the Windows computers, right? It's got to be Oregon Trail 2, okay?
One of the things just about this is that it's funny. One of the kind of criticism, so far, since my thing has come out, I've had people asking both on Twitter and on a podcast, which I did yesterday, like, wait, why millennial? Like, what's with the generational thing? Are you buying into generational politics? And they're, well, no, it's just a way of kind of categorizing it in place and talking about certain waves of left activism. But what occurs to me is that, I mean, what you're saying, you know, it's really the younger millennials, which are
90s kids.
90s kids, right. And that, I think, tallies with a division that I've made before as well, I think, like, which is, in my head, the millennials isn't necessarily a very coherent category. Because in terms of the formative moment, in terms of the global financial crisis and the effects that that has on the job market and people's prospects and the way that they see the world and the way that they see the world as not one of kind of untrammeled and continual growth, but much more turbulent, etc. Like that actually divides the millennials. I was already out of university by that point and into the job market. And it wasn't so earth shattering as it would have been for someone who's 5 years, much less 10 years younger, who would still be also millennials. So I guess maybe you're kind of in making that division and trying to make that division even stronger, saying that, you know, actually we shouldn't be talking about, maybe millennials is the wrong term even, because it's like, it's a net that catches too many fish.
Yeah, it does. It does. And because it's just this tiny window of people, you know, because the cell phone comes along pretty quickly, right? Like, what were these millennials, the my 90s kids, doing in school? They were messaging each other on AOL Instant Messenger. All of their communication was text. Everything they did was writing. There was no video. There was no, the image came late, right? Those image macro memes came very late, right as we were getting ready to go to college. Facebook and Twitter, these things come late, but we're the first ones there, and we're there in high school, right? This, I think, created for us a sense that we understood this stuff. We were digital natives, the first digital natives. And we felt we grasped internet culture. And so we thought that we could use our knowledge of internet culture, because we were the only adults who had it, to make a huge change in politics. We had this delusion that our knowledge of the internet, that the internet was a transformational thing, and that we had knowledge of it that was unique, that other adults did not have, and that therefore we had some advantage from being computer people over these people, that we could somehow make up for the fact that society was disunited and disorganized, that there was no robust public sphere. You know, all of the old people are watching television. You know, they're on the phone. They're lost in this analog stuff, and they're not going to see us coming, and they're not going to be able to deal with us. And that was what gave us that spontaneity. We tried to stage a coup through the computer of the Democratic Party, of public life, and it was all through the computer. So our ability to exist as a moment was grounded on the plausibility of that. And I describe it in the piece as a kind of window of plausibility that gradually closed and opened up really big in 2015. Prior to 2015, the attempts to use the computer didn't really work. You had some whispers of stuff.
So although it was much more enthusiastically embraced before 2015, I mean, with the street protests, which is the subject of Vincent Bevan's book, where he, really kind of looking around the world, he actually doesn't talk very much about you know, the first world, to use an anachronism. But there was like much more enthusiastic the embrace in terms of Facebook is going to change the world, right?
Yeah, they liked it because it hadn't yet become something that was used in opposition to them. At that point, it was being used in movements that were broadly aligned with the Gen X left and the Gen X establishment and the way that they like to think about how things ought to go. And it was in 2015 and 16 that really, really changed. We had a little bit of stuff that was against them in 08 and 12. I talk about Ron Paul in the piece, and I think Ron Paul captures.
Yeah, actually, explain that. I think that's nice. Yeah, that's neat. Yeah. Explain that.
Yeah, because there was a huge amount of internet energy for Ron Paul. If you were on the computer in the late late aughts and early tens, Ron Paul was everywhere on the computer, and this libertarian stuff was everywhere on the computer. And people who lived on the computer thought, wow, it's everywhere on the computer. It's got to be everywhere in real politics, too. Surely he's going to do really well. He's going to get all these votes. And that never happened. In 08, he got 6% in the Republican primary. In 2012, he got maybe 11%. So there was this sense that internet energy doesn't translate. You can maybe use it to get some mailers out. You might be able to use it in, to raise awareness for certain specific niche issues. But it's not going to be able to do the work of a political campaign. It's not television. It's not a newspaper. It's not media, right? It becomes media in 2015-16. And that's when these people realize that if they don't get control of it, it's going to be a base for people to enter in with no gatekeeping. And this obsession post-2016, you know, in like the Levitsky and Zablatt book, it's all about gatekeeping. We need to bring back gatekeeping because we've lost the gates, right? And where did they lose the gates? They lost the gates on the internet, right? Because Donald Trump, Fox can't decide whether Donald Trump succeeds. Donald Trump decides whether Fox succeeds. How can Donald Trump do that? Well, it's not individually. It's because he dominates the internet. And the internet metastasizes in 2015 to the point where Fox can be dragged around by the internet. And this is what Steve Bannon got so animated about and what those Trumpers get so animated about with their meme magic, this idea that memes can overcome establishment institutions. That was the kind of millennial right version of this that went on over there in their based meme spaces with their frogs and all of that, all their gripers, all of that stuff. That was also internet people doing weird internet meme stuff.
Well, it's funny, actually, because I was asked by an editor, in the case of Julius Krein, about, you know, what about the millennial right? Because it's all about the millennial left. I actually kind of had to pause for a second just to think about that and thought, well, yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, they go through the same cycle. But the difference is that the right is characterized ultimately by its opportunism rather than its utopianism. And therefore, it's actually able to insert itself into this new world of internet much more easily because it's able to just, you know, throw out some stupid memes and not really necessarily have to account for how that might accord or not with like its own political tradition, you know. So you get the kind of alt-right thing of being extremely transgressive at the same time as supposedly being, you know, conservative in some way, and these contradictions, which the right never has to really deal with, doesn't really be held to account for. Maybe, you know, once in a while, it gets outflanked by someone on the right who is more purist and more kind of genuinely conservative. But that's kind of rare, you know. It goes with the flow, and it goes with capital. So it ultimately kind of doesn't have to swim upstream in the way that the left does. I mean, I use the example of my piece about Brazil, where it was able, this kind of new group was able to completely astroturf itself and be the kind of, you know, scrappy street fighting anti-establishment force that, you know, stood against the establishment, except the establishment here is the government, which was the center-left party in charge, was the Workers' Party. And it's able to do that quite effectively and capture that energy in a way that the left hasn't. And I think there ends up being a kind of left penis envy. Like, oh, why can't we just do what the right does? Like, they're completely, you know, they're seemingly unbound by any principle. Why can't we just be that opportunistic and do what we need to, you know, to gain power? Do you see this kind of playing out?
I think in 2015, we were competitive from a meme standpoint. We had the Bernie versus Hillary meme. You know, we had Bernie Sanders' dank meme stash. We had some very powerful meme stuff at the beginning of the period. But gradually, every year throughout the period of the millennial left, which I really think is a five-year period, we got worse at this. And they got better at it as we got worse. And we got worse in part because all of the Gen Xers, once they saw this energy that we kicked up on the internet, they all wanted to take it and control it and use it. So a bunch of them started trying to discipline us and tell us what we were allowed to do or not allowed to do with our memes. And they tried to colonize us and subordinate us to them and their old 80s stuff that doesn't work. So there was this resistance on our part, not resistance politics, but resistance to resistance politics. This emphasis we had on it's got to be economic rights, it's got to be healthcare for all, education for all, jobs for all, Medicare for all, tuition-free college, big, big universal programs, in-kind benefits, right? Get control of the healthcare sector, give everybody access to healthcare, and also shrink the size of the sector, cut the bloat in the sector. Big positive projects, right? And these people came in and they're going, well, what about, racism? What about, imperialism? What about these things that we were talking about before you guys showed up? You guys have to make sure that you tick all the boxes and you talk about all of these things in all of the right ways. And we decide what those right things are. And I think that is part of why we became so uncool. We were gradually subordinated to that.
So but I mean, wait, are you putting the blame for the woke undermining of the kind of more universalist and economic politics of left populist moment on older millennials and Gen Xers? You think it's a generational thing? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 80s people. I think that 80s people were really uncool. And then, millennials who go to college, right? The college interaction is an interaction between the undergraduates and the professors and the grad students. And I don't see what happened as coming from just from 90s kids. I see this because I went to school in Indiana. I went to high school in Indiana, and I saw that friends of mine who went to college had an interaction there that caused them to get sucked up into this stuff. And friends of mine who didn't go to college in the States didn't have this interaction, right? If you go back to an Indiana high school in the 10s, you'll find all sorts of pre-woke, Gen X, 90s humor, South Park, all of that. Everybody laughed at all of the, people doing foreign accents. All of that stuff in the 2000s was everywhere in millennial culture, right? Then some people go to college and they decide that they can't do any of that and none of that's acceptable anymore. And the people who are still doing that stuff are beneath them, right? And I went to school in the UK, so I was in a little bit of a weird position because I didn't go to an American college for undergrad. So I wasn't in this space in the same way. But my friends who didn't go to college, they continued to like this stuff and be into this stuff. And so I saw, some of these people get sucked up into this other kind of politics. And then also, post 2016, they started clamping down on the internet and making it very difficult to share stuff. And as they compressed the amount of money and amount of attention that was available for political content on Facebook and Twitter, this had a nasty, nasty effect of putting everybody in competition for eyeballs and really sharp competition. As people were getting older, and so as they got older and some people started having kids or thinking about having kids, they got more focused on having money as a consequence of getting older, which always happens. And of course, that hit the 80s people harder and it hit them first and it had more of an effect on them and then only gradually got to us. The crushing of it goes on over the course of that whole span. And I think by the time we got to 2018, it was really obvious that it was going on. And it became possible to start trying to openly resist it. And then that was where I came in 2018, 2019, 2020 with What's Left and The Left Is Not a Church and all of this struggle to preserve the energy of 2015-16 as it was gradually ground down and turned into a paste. And now they're trying to finish the job by saying not only have we completely destroyed all of that, but we're going to lump what you did in with the Occupy people, which to me is, this is destroying the history of my computer people.
Yeah. I mean, I love the quaintness of computer people. I guess that's deliberate. But I also like Yeah, go on.
What the computer people have done, you know, most of them are completely turned off now, and they've gone back into the computer because the computer is their true home. So they got into crypto and they got into AI, and a lot of them are working as engineers. They're in tech. And these people, they don't talk about politics anymore. They don't really post. They are hiding from it, a lot of them. And I, you know, if any of them are listening, I see you, because I am one of you, but not in STEM. You know, I have a brother who's an engineer. My father was an engineer. You know, I love my computer people.
Right. No, I mean, I guess that, yeah, I find that kind of plausible. And I mean, it certainly underlines the way that the millennial left was a brief moment. And you kind of put it, you know, you kind of try to inscribe that into internet history. You're like, well, it's a moment in internet history rather than the internet being a means that this politics used to pursue its ends. And I mean, it is true that when we kind of think about who has been thrown up from our generation as political leaders on either side of the Atlantic with kind of broad recognition and an audience, and maybe audience already kind of presupposes what we're talking about, but it's people like Bhaskar Sankara and Aaron Bastani, like in the UK, with like Navarre Media, that like media initiatives have been the lasting, I say this, you know, hosting a podcast, whatever, nowhere near as many listeners as or readers as Jacobin or Navarra, but like the, you know, nevertheless, you know, the that seems to be the legacy of the thing. And I'm kind of in two minds about it. I mean, obviously, it's not a political success, right? Like, doesn't create even a community, really. But one could say that, you know, trying to make the best case for it, that if we're going to need to be, I don't want to say monastic about politics. I know you've kind of are interested in this, but, you know, this idea of kind of going away, forgetting all about kind of policy, but even forgetting about politics, really, in any kind of more engaged sense, and kind of turning to culture and philosophy, not as a kind of evasion, but as a kind of as an attempt to rebuild things from the ground up. Something I remember people making the argument for, people that I was around, you know, older people back in the 2000s, and I was just so allergic to that. I was like, oh yeah, whatever, old people kind of retiring basically to do philosophy and, you know, in the salon or whatever. But I think if that is going to be, you know, if that were to be the solution, and I'm skeptical but also intrigued by what it might have, like it would need some ways to discuss these things, right? And so media would be part of it, wouldn't it?
Yeah. You know, I think that media is great still when people are not making their money principally from it. I think when people are making their money principally from it, the incentive structure is overdetermined in a way that makes it impossible for them to be the kind of forum that we need. And of course, to not make most of your money from the media, your media platform has to stay small enough and marginal enough. Right, like I do podcasting too. I'm not just someone who goes away and writes a book. I do Political Theory 101. I do the LAC. You know, I still pod. I still do media.
Good podcast to check out. Yeah,
right.
I see.
I still think that there's some room for some media, but the role that we thought that the media was going to play in 2015, that we could through the computer create a bunch of media that could then reach all of the people on the computer and go around the TV and go around the executives and go around the newspapers and the establishment media, and then bring these people together, unite them in some way so that we could do something concrete like Medicare for All. That image of what the media can do is completely dead. And that image of what the internet and what the computer can do is completely dead. We now have an enormous amount of disunity. So we can have our like siloed niche little bubbles where we talk about different kinds of things that are interesting for us, but it's not going to be the same kind of thing that it was. It's going to be more monastic. insofar as it works. And the stuff that I'm criticizing is not stuff that is performing that monastic kind of let's keep the discussion going role. It's the stuff that is still pretending as if it is part of that 2015-2016 thing that imagines that it can have this kind of uniting role. And I see evidence of it in a lot of people when they talk about, you know, what's important in the 2024 election when they start talking about the election. They just assume that the stuff that they've been talking about in left media matters for voters. They assume things like Gaza, you know, matters for voters. They assume things like Julian Assange, you know, matters for voters. And then you look at the issue polling, and nothing that the millennial left, any version of it, either the computer people or the pre and post phone people, none of that stuff is in people's top five issues. It's all very much at the bottom of the list. And there's a total out of touchness now. So if you think that by doing media, by being on the computer, that you're in touch with the culture, which we used to think was true, that's completely false now. There is no longer such a thing as the culture. And insofar as there is, it's you know, much more focused around stuff like cost of living and immigration than it is anything that anybody in any version of the millennial left has been talking about.
Yeah, I buy that. And sometimes that's one of those things in politics that you just have to ride out, right? I mean, if you have in the best case of scenario, you actually have a kind of organized political party with some weight to it, some capillarity, cadres being formed, all the rest of it, that there are moments in politics where you just have to kind of wait them out, that there might be a kind of conservative swing, things might turn against you, etc. And that probably applies both to parliamentary politics as to, you know, para or extra parliamentary politics, revolutionary politics, etc. These things go through rhythms, there are moments, which is why the whole discussion about spontaneity versus organization, I think to a certain extent kind of mistakes what is really at stake insofar as kind of both are necessary, and it's not an either or. And I think in some ways the division in the millennial left, which you're kind of, you know, tangling with between the kind of protest moment and the kind of populist electoral moment, in some ways those each represent come in to stand for spontaneity, you know, just occupy the square and then good things happen, and organization, like, oh, well, we'll actually do this through formal means. And actually that mischaracterizes what has actually happened, insofar as I think both spontaneity and organization were lacking in throughout those moments, right?
Yeah. And insofar as we came close to combining them, it was organizing through the party, but then the speed and pace, which you could get off the internet and the computer.
Someone else's party, it's important to say as well.
But yes, know, both well, Labor that, and was, Democrat. That was the coup aspect to it, right? It was an attempt to do a coup through the internet. So it was organized because a coup has to be organized, but it was spontaneous and quick in the way that a coup has to be spontaneous and quick.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. And I think that that's fine if there's a logic to it in terms of taking over a party. Not the Democrats, I don't think. Labor, perhaps a little bit more so. You know, that one could follow the argument at least that it's that there's some coherence to it and some plausibility to it. But, you know,
especially compared to Occupy. If you compare it to Occupy, it's an interesting idea, right? Yeah. And of course, it completely failed. And I am the first to say it's completely failed and we should all go into despair. But as part of trying to grasp how we ended up making the mistakes that we made, I think it's important to remember why this was a compelling idea. And it was compelling because nobody had tried to use the computer and the internet to do this. So even if it seemed like, you know, it probably won't work, or you know, the internet is a, you know, come on, the internet, really? Nobody used to take the internet seriously. But because nobody had ever really tried it, and there had been, with Ron Paul, increasing levels of success, you know, 6%, then 11%. Well, what if we could do that, but for someone on the left, and we did it in another 5 years or another 10 years when the internet's bigger? You know, what could you do with that? I think it was understandable how this got going. And I think it was a much more admirable thing than the Occupy stuff and the resistance lib stuff. And we've part of how they killed us was by lumping us in with that stuff and tying us to that stuff, because the general public doesn't like that stuff. It doesn't like the anti-police. It doesn't like the anti-ICE. It doesn't like the abolish this, abolish that. The general public hates all that anarchist stuff. And part of how they destroyed us was by tying us to that stuff. And they did it through the squad. They did it through tying Bernie to the squad and creating a situation where Bernie needed the squad just to get through the Democratic primaries. And that's how they strangled it. I'm not suggesting that there's some kind of counterfactual situation where it could have gone another way. We weren't in a strong enough position in society. We didn't have the resources, ultimately. But I think that what we tried to do, if you separate it from that other stuff, is a more interesting project than it seems in retrospect, now that it's been lumped together with all that horrible stuff.
There strikes me that there's a certain parallel in the left's envy, you know, prior to this whole moment of the media or having a powerful machine, right? And the powerful machine might be a megaphone or it might be like a political party. And so the left thought if it could just get hold of the megaphone, like it had, was always envious that the establishment, both left and right, had, that then it could communicate to the people and tell them the truth. Like, the Iraq war is bogus, or, you know, Obama's bailouts are bullshit, or whatever it might be. If only we could just reach all the people. And then, like, what if you get hold of the machine, right? So you get hold of social media, which is able to communicate to all these people. Then we can just pass on the good word, right? And let people know the truth. And then likewise with the party, like, maybe we can just grab this party by stealth in some way, by surprise, mount this coup, and then we'll have all these tools at our disposal, which we have always been envious that they have had and we haven't.
And a lot of it was writing, because so much of what the computer people did, you know, was write. We blogged and we wrote these big, you know, Facebook posts, and we tweeted, which was all words. It was all originally all words. So we thought, you know, we can put out a blog post that explains to people how they're going to actually end up with more money in their pocket, even though we're going to raise taxes to nationalize the healthcare system. We're going to be able to explain this to people, and we're going to be able to get this around because we're going to have a kind of vanguard of computer people who will disseminate this stuff to their friends and family through their feeds. We're going to be able to actually raise the level of education about policy issues. We're going to raise consciousness. This is what we thought we were going to be able to do with this, right? And then now blogs have been killed. They've been economically murdered as a mechanism for trying to do this, because you can no longer get someone to even read something that's 1,500 words long at scale. You know, I got 1 million people to read a blog post that had a bunch of charts in it about austerity, you know, in the 2015 UK general election. I got, you know, 500,000 people to read a blog post about how Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are totally different when it comes to economic inequality, you know, in 2016. You know, these big long posts with like graphs and shit. It's ridiculous that this stuff was able to get around. Nobody would even commission anything like this anymore. Nobody would pay money for it. And I just had a little blog with my name. And I, at that time, I didn't have a PhD. I didn't have any qualifications for talking, really, to speak of. But you could get this stuff all over the internet. Now it has to be video, and it's got to be quick. And we're back into a world where that's very similar to a television thing, to something you'd see on cable that's got to be a five minute at most. I mean, now it's, you know, TikTok is 1 minute, 2 minutes, and it's video and it's audio, and there's got to be image, right? Like, you're doing video now because you've got to do video. Video is the way to reach people.
Because perverts want to watch. I don't know why.
Yeah, the pivot to video is part of this transformation of the entire political economy of the media that completely killed the model, totally, to the point where it seems ridiculous that anyone thought this could be done. But in 2015, it was really a completely different world. And part of what's happening is that the changes that were made in how the political economy of the internet worked, like, there was a YouTube channel called Film Cow that was huge when I was a kid. This guy, he made these, you know, llamas with hats. You ever heard of llamas with hats? You know, one of the llamas, he kills people, and the other llama, you know, goes, "Oh no, you know, why have you done this?" Right? This guy, he used to have huge view counts. And then the YouTube algorithm changed and his content was considered too controversial and a lot of it was demonetized and suddenly he couldn't get his stuff spread around so much. So he had to transition to a patron model and it vastly reduced his income. And this guy who was at the center of YouTube culture, who was one of the very biggest YouTubers, was reduced to a peripheral position. It's not because he got less funny or his content got less good. It's because the political economy of YouTube completely changed. And you could tell this story, and the people who are content creators on the different platforms could do it much better than I can, you know, of how YouTube changed, how Facebook changed, how Twitter changed. All of these places completely changed. And they're unrecognizable versus 2015 from a content creation standpoint. The viewer experience and the user experience hasn't changed as dramatically. It's been slower. It's been more gradual. And they've always been able to say, no, this stuff isn't ruining YouTube. No, it's not ruining Facebook. It's not ruining Twitter. And then against this, there's a set of people who went, oh, we have to go get something else. We've got to go to, you know, Twitch. We've got to go somewhere else. All of the other places that people tried to go, none of them got off the ground. You know, Vine died. All of this other stuff died. So,
other than TikTok, which is the only place with kind of any real energy to it and excitement about its potential, which no doubt will evaporate in due course.
And what potential is that? These videos are really short. They're really quick. Instagram, similarly, it's all pictures. It's not what we were doing. The reason we thought this could work is that we could write stuff. And we were all great writers because we went home and we messaged our friends and that's all we did. You know, we didn't go ride bikes and hang out in person. We're not from the 80s. We messaged our friends. So we got really good at writing and communicating in language. And this is gone now. No one will ever be this good at writing in language again. There's obviously what was possible.
I don't know if there's a peak of, yeah, but I mean, certainly there's a wider discussion, much deeper historical and philosophical discussion about what a post-literate culture actually means and where that'll go. I don't know if I wouldn't do that right now, but you know, if you want to comment on that, go ahead. But what I did want to say is that there's an interesting reversal from the Gen X to the millennial left, to put it that way, from a left that was obsessed, you know, pathologically obsessed with the media, that was its main critical object. The media was at fault for everything, and hence all the stupid theories of brainwashing, which itself is a product of the defeat of the 60s moment as it fades into the 70s and then 80s and the you know, Reaganite counter-revolution. I'm not sure if that's the right counter-revolution is indeed correct. But anyway, however you want to, you know, that reactionary moment, all is ultimately pinned down on the media because the left loses the masses, it loses the working class, and it has to turn to the people and go, how the fuck could you do this? How could you abandon us? Well, it must be the media who have brainwashed you. So anyway, there's this kind of pathological obsession with the media through the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s. And indeed, the media is powerful. It's not insignificant, but it is, you know, the kind of fetishization of it becomes really problematic. And then the internet comes along and all that's forgotten and it's embraced because it's like, these are the good, exciting people. Nowadays, people are critical of the internet, right? So I think it's not like we're in a, you know, internet enthusiast phase where this is seen as the counterpart to the kind of bad TV or something. I mean, that would be itself very antiquated. That's at least 10 years out of date, I would say. But nevertheless, I don't think the critique of the internet has come to dominate, you know, insofar as the internet is the media of the day, the critique of the internet hasn't developed to the same degree. I don't mean in terms of sophistication, because in many ways it's more sophisticated than the critiques of dumb TV, of the idiot box. But it's less of a feature, of a central feature of the left. And I wonder what your thoughts are on this and whether you think it will become and whether it should become more central.
I think there's heavy generational issues with trying to critique the internet because the relationship to the internet varies so enormously depending on when you were born. In even these tiny little windows of 5 years here or there, the whole experience of the internet is completely different if you were born in the early 90s versus the early 80s. And it's totally different if you were born in the early aughts versus the early 90s. And so when older people are criticizing the internet, younger people go, well, you don't know what the internet is. And that's what we did. And And they were right and they were wrong, right? They were right to say you're over-relying on the media in general. It doesn't matter what form the media takes. You're over-relying on the media. You are people who live in the computer, so you don't have any friends. You don't go outside. You don't touch grass. You don't join civil society organizations. When you do try to join organizations, you guys are too individualistic and power-hungry, control freaks who can't get along with each other. And so how are you supposed to be able to organize anything? All of that was true. At the same time, none of those people could meme. None of those people understood the culture. None of those people could post. They couldn't make content. They didn't, you know, they couldn't say these things in our space in a way where we could be convinced by it. And the same thing goes, I'm sure, for the TikTok people. When I go, TikTok is completely useless, they would say to me, well, you don't know how to TikTok. You can't post. You're not on TikTok. And all of that would be true. And I would be right in one sense, but they would also be right in another sense. And this is the issue with the internet, because the form of it has changed so much. It's never possible for even two sections within the same generation to participate in the same conversation about it. Maybe that will change if the pace of technological change slows. But I, you know, that's a question about how fast the tech is going to change. And I defer to the STEM people on that.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, it's hard to know, but it seems that the cycle of innovation, even stupid innovations in kind of communications technology, seems to, you know, have a ways to go yet still. I mean, but obviously there's a wider discussion also about technological innovation and the amount of capital and interest and energy being funneled into those sorts of things as opposed to other technologies. But again, that's sort of another discussion. Like, as concerns kind of the left and media, I wonder whether, you know, I mean, maybe I'm kind of drilling at the same point again, but, you know, to what extent there needs to be a kind of tech lash moment. And I'm very ambivalent on it. And I'm someone who was very technophilic, you know, and was like, oh, this, not never bought into, you know, Facebook's going to change the world, but wow, there's also, you know, all sorts of possibilities here. This is pretty exciting. I wasn't like a tech person or at the cutting edge of it in any way, but kind of generally enthusiastic and kind of dismissive of people who would be skeptical of it, you know, kind of being like poo-pooing the idea to a stage now where I'm not technophobic, because that would be the wrong way to describe it, but certainly kind of pretty skeptical about the possibilities and what and the transformations of culture that it's bringing in. But I think we're also on the verge of something quite dramatic in terms of the capacity to believe in images, you know, of believe anything that you see on the internet, right? And I'm not sure how that plays out, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. But like,
yeah,
right. There's an element where it's like that you can see a positive element that people just kind of drop out of the internet. They're like, listen, this is a bullshit factory. Nothing is real. It's a world of dreams. Which, fine, if you're going to go into that purely for whatever pornographic purposes, literally or metaphorically. But otherwise, it's useless, or that it leads to such a collapse in trust that it makes, you know, even kind of the usual face-to-face trust problematic. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that every generation and every segment within a generation rejects the tech that comes after it as evil, right? While at the same time holding desperately onto its own tech. Right. So the boomers will say that the internet is this terrible place where everybody gets fake news while they watch cable TV, and they watch cable TV every night. Right. And we will say, you know, the personal computer, you know, what a wonderful world it was. Windows 95, you know, go listen to that Dreamscape on YouTube. It's great. But when it comes to TikTok, we'll go, oh, this is the, you know, this is the bad, terrible stuff where it's all coming off the rails. The TikTok people, they get their phone out whenever they're stressed out, whenever they're anxious. They immediately get it out, immediately. And they watch something of some duration. And their videos are short, so they can watch it and then immediately come back to what they're doing in real life, right? So I think that eventually something will come along that those people don't like or that they reject, but we can't fathom what that will be. But I think the people who try to suggest that there can be a general rejection of technology neglect the fact that for each generation and each cohort, the tech that you've adopted is your home. It's where you live. It's your safe place. And it's where you go when you're stressed out or you're anxious, right? If I have a bad day, what do? I go home, I get on my computer, and I play a game. and I listen to some tunes or I listen to a podcast and I zone out, right? And the TikTokers, they get on their phone, and the boomers, they go watch TV. We all do this. We just all do it a little bit differently. And the thing that unites us is that we're all totally psychologically dependent on the tech to suit us, all of us. And the people who think that you can reject it, they can reject other people's tech, but nobody rejects their own tech. Nobody does. Everybody comes home to their home, whether it's the TV or the computer or the phone.
No, fair enough. I'm going to leave that there, but working towards a conclusion on one last thing. On the left populist moment, which is over and was short, you know, remarkably short, would be a footnote really in history, and or even reduced to being merely a chapter within another history, like internet history, as you're kind of suggesting. I wonder, my take, I think, fundamentally, is that it was so deeply problematic because it was enticing. The left populist gamble seemed plausible. You could try to play those cards, right? You could try to get a president elected who was on your side. And that seemed plausible, ignoring all the deeper backdrop of knowing how impossible that would be to be progressive in any way, how that would be kind of stabbed in the back from one side or the other, and would be undermined, and would offer, and that the simple lack of kind of fortitude on the part of a Bernie Sanders to actually pursue these policies once in government would be so strong that it would leave such a bad taste in the mouth that it's to undermine any future projects, unless it actually led to the creation of some new organizations outside of the mainstream parties. Now, we all know that that didn't happen. So looking back, you have to reflect on it and say, actually, that was bad. You know, to put it really crudely, that was a bad thing to have happened, because what should have died didn't die. The left populist moment gave the left a new life, which probably led it to believe that it could continue without a much more deep reassessment of its own ideas, let alone its practices, which I think it, to a certain extent, is secondary here. Do you come to the same conclusion?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the horizon for what it could have been is, imagine a world where Sanders wins in 2016 instead of Trump. And just like as happened for Trump, right? Trump fought the Republican Party on every issue where he tried to do anything that was meaningfully different from what a standard Mitt Romney Republican would have done. He struggled to accomplish very much. I'm sure the same thing would have happened for Sanders, right? The thing that would have been interesting is that we would have all considered these Democrats to be sabotaging what he was doing. The obvious conflict between him and the establishment Democrats would have been something we would have been very conscious of. And so, similar to what's going on in the Republican Party, there would be very intense agonism within the Democratic Party. And we might have thought that maybe something could have eventually emerged from that or come from that. I think most people who are into this, the thought was that there could be some kind of internal clash that could lead to some sort of split in the Democratic Party or regeneration of it, or some kind of purge of it. There's people talk about, what if Corbyn just purged the Labour Party? What if he did the things that Starmer had done? Well, the newspapers would have opposed him, but his core internet computer people would have supported it. And the thought, you know, the delusional thought was that that was enough, that the internet and computer people could somehow spearhead it. And it is a delusion that comes from just how bankrupt the whole scene was, how little else there was to do, and how new the internet and the computers were. And when I talk to younger people about this, when I talk to Zoomers about what we tried to do, they just like, you know, that's obviously stupid. Why would you do that? And I'm sure people who have been listening, I've been trying to channel something in this episode, something I no longer believe in, but I remember believing in. Something that I want us to remember that we really used to believe. Because a lot of us are trying now to say, oh, I didn't really buy that. I didn't really think we could do it with the computer. Yes, we did. That's what we believed. We were nuts. We were really nuts. But I think we have to remember how nuts we were. And we have to remember that this is how you end up wasting a bunch of time. You do something which only looks reasonable within a very particular moment and milieu, and which will look crazy both to people from before that moment and people after that moment. To be a computer person, millennial leftist, is to have this kind of deranged, crazy brain thing that, you know, I think most of what we see now is associated with Trump and the people on the in the right millennial space. We still see some of that crazy brain memer stuff. And that's because Trump is still around and Trump is still someone who has some level of electoral viability. And I think all of that will go away after Trump is gone. I think the same thing will happen in the right as has happened with us, because they have all the same internal divisions that we have. It's just they've still got the unifying figure of Trump.
But also you can Trumpify the GOP and have it still kind of function as a machine, although we'll see how far that actually goes, you know, kind of across electoral districts and at all levels of government. But anyway, you can't imagine a Bernie-fied Democratic Party, certainly not to the full extent of what that would mean, you know, in terms of its more radical proponents.
Whenever I talk about this, the two sides of me are just constantly at war with each other. There's the me that wrote the book, which is the sober me, the me that recognizes that we're in this situation of despair. And then there's this younger version of me, this 2015, 2016 version of me that has this desire to somehow try to say that there was something, and they ruined it, but we had something.
No, but there was something, but I think the something that was there really was there insofar as it being a kind of insurrectionary or proto-insurrectionary moment, even if it expresses itself more at the ballot box or in Anglophone countries, but in other places in mass street protests, like that was there. And it hasn't gone entirely because of the turbulence of the age means that I think these moments will spring up unexpectedly in many cases. And I think we have to be prepared for that, but also to, in terms of striking with the iron's hot, we have to be, quite aware of what the possibilities and the limits of that are and what we are trying to achieve. And I think the creating the capacity for future politics is the best that can be hoped for in a kind of immediate term, rather than trying to, say, like, get a good guy elected and undoing neoliberalism through executive power.
Well, I think what's likely to happen is that it will just take the form of protests and anti and abolish, and that there will be another 20 years of that in all likelihood. You know, the moment where maybe it could be something else, where maybe there was something else we could do that was positive, was the end of history compressed the imaginarium so much and compressed what we believed we could do so much that it reduced our willingness to organize in a very serious way. And it produced all this horizontalist anarchist stuff that wasn't really capable of doing anything. So even if you did go out and try to join organizations and do stuff, you were in these organizations that were inert because they didn't really have confidence in themselves or confidence in what they were doing. And that the millennial left period is this period where that imaginarium opens up a bit, and there's this thought that maybe we can do in-kind benefits and economic rights and bigger stuff. That stuff is small compared with the ultimate final ends of socialism, but it's really big compared with what the Gen Xers tried to do and with what the Zoomers and the contemporary left is trying to do in terms of Gaza and in terms of COVID and in terms of this other stuff, which is just little tiny resistance activities compared to what to this. But it required a delusion about the internet to even begin. And so because it required a delusion about the internet to begin, it was always fated to fall apart and to end in disappointment. There will be more discontents, but can these discontents take that kind of form, given that nobody will ever believe in the internet the way that we believed in it? It will never. We're back in the 90s in terms of what people believe can happen, with less capacity than we had then, with less ability to influence public discussion than we had then. It requires a little bit of a delusion, I think, to get going. And this is the thing about it. Yes, it was delusional, but if we, at some point, there's going to need to be a delusion about what can be done just to even begin a movement. Somebody will have to believe something unreasonable, even to get something going. And our unreasonable conceit is that the internet is magic. And if that conceit is gone, you know, what will be the new conceit that will get people to try things? Because in the beginning, it's always nuts. In the beginning, you're always trying to do something that's so out of touch with regular politics or the regular culture.
Sure. But I guess there's a difference between being founded on a delusion and founded on a dream so big that it might be, you know, because ultimately the delusion there is just about means, not about ends. I mean, that's the difference. It's not saying that, you know, it's saying that we might, through the internet, achieve these goals. And the goals are not, they're not revolutionary goals. You know, they're reformist goals. But it's a dream about the tools that you might use ultimately to get there, rather than it being a dream about, well, we might achieve and build a socialist society. You know, that we might have human emancipation. I think that's the difference, right? That's maybe a delusion, which is maybe impossible. Who knows? But that might be a necessary delusion versus the delusion that what if we do step on this step and then that'll lead us to something better. You know, I think that's the difference.
It might have led us there, though. You know, like if we had managed to get further with it than we did, then the delusions might have begot additional, more interesting delusions. And I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that there's often this sharp distinction that's made between, you know, healthcare programs, education programs, but a lot of that stuff creates time and energy for people to think about what they want to do. It creates time and energy for people to contemplate, you know, what's really in their interest. And ultimately, that's what causes people to get the higher ideals and to think about, you know, what could they have that's more. And I've always thought that that stuff is connected in some way, ultimately, to the revolutionary ends, that the way to kick off and begin revolutionary energy would be to accomplish something like healthcare for everybody or education for everybody, to demonstrate that there's something we can do. Just to demonstrate that we can actually do something, because it's been so long since the left has actually done anything for anyone. You know, just demonstrate we can do anything. And then from there, you know, it might have been possible for people who had the benefit of free college or who had the benefit of free healthcare to go, well, do I really like the way my workplace is run? Do I really, really like you know, what I'm doing with my life? There would be a little bit more time and energy freed up for these things. Whereas now, you know, people go, well, I can't quit my job because I'll lose my health insurance. I can't go back to school because I'll be loaded up with debt. I can't change my life because of all of these impediments. I've got to just keep going. And therefore, I have to convince myself that my life is okay and that I'm doing what I ought to be doing. So I need the ideology, because otherwise I'll be too upset. You know, so I go and go get it because I need it psychologically to keep going. And I think that we might have, if we had actually been able to get anywhere with what we were doing, we might have kicked off a virtuous series of events. That's what we were trying to do. Now, I don't really think that. When I go back into my head and I go, come on, you know, what could we really do here?
I made the same argument as well in defense of it, that, well, you might need to achieve some sort of reform, even limited, to show that, you know, politics is possible, to then start thinking in more grand terms. But I think that I kind of also find myself struggling to believe that as well. Or rather, insofar as you need kind of a proof of concept, the proof of concept has to be much more immediate. I mean, in terms of like labor militancy, of winning a better deal, but like what the UAW has managed to do now, like that seems to be a much more positive and promising proof of and, you know, I'm not overselling it. It's just at a very small level.
They'll just close those factories if it gets to be too much. They'll, you know, just like they thought about doing in 08, they'll close up all those auto plants and ship them off to Asia. That's what they'll do if it gets far enough.
But again, I think the difference there is that it demonstrates the capacity, you know, demonstrates to oneself, those who are the agents there, capacity for self-organization, rather than we can achieve these good things. These things that, or even things that people give us, right? So it's not just through politics, through formal politics, we have achieved, you know, better healthcare. It's something like, we know that we can organize ourselves into something that fights for something.
But what pushed us into this is that it was so obvious that we couldn't organize ourselves into something that fights for something. That was why we tried all of this, because decades and decades and decades of people trying to do radical union organizing, trying to create radical anarchist groups that did social, you know, society building. None of that worked in the 90s, in the aughts. None of that is working now, really. None of it's really working. And so I think, you know, there's a set of people who go, you know, those silly, you know, electoralists, what you really have to do is go organize society. You can't organize society in the way that people did in the 19th century, because everybody's atomized and nobody gets along. And the divisions, go all the way down into everything. You try to bring people together, and the fact that some of them went to college and some of them didn't, and some of them speak the fancy language and some of them don't, immediately gets in your way. You know, nobody can organize anymore in a way that produces the kind of unity that we used to produce. And we tried to do it with the internet, and we failed to do that because the division goes so deep. And that's what postmodernism is an attempt to grapple with, I think, is this division. A lot of it's misrecognized and essentialized and naturalized. A lot of postmodernists suggest that this is just essentially how human beings are. And I think that's a mistake. The degree to which society is or isn't divided waxes and wanes across time. But the thing we're grappling with is that we have an unprecedented level of division, and nobody's able to organize past or through or around it. And the internet was one last try to do this by some other means. But we're not just going to be able to go back to 19th century methods. You know, that the reason we tried the internet thing is that stuff hadn't worked for 20 or 30 years.
All right. I think maybe we'll leave that there. But I think that's a nice place to finish on, not because it's glum, even despondent, but actually because maybe it's worth thinking through the internet and the moment of kind of around 2015 as the last moment that we didn't all hate each other, whether we might come to love each other once again, because that would be hallmark and also an incorrect way of viewing things, but in some way that we might get kind of past this division. So anyway, stuff
my
to think
cold,
about
dead computer heart is moved by what you're saying.
Well,
there's
exactly.
Something in it.
Yeah. No, good. I hope everyone weeps at that. That'll be great. Anyway, thanks, Benjamin. This has been great as usual.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome.